This is one of the first major sit-downs that Peter Robinson has done since he stood down from his role as First Minister of Northern Ireland. I began by asking Peter Robinson if he regretted not having supported the Good Friday Agreement from the beginning.
I think events justified the decision that we took as a party at that time, and indeed the subsequent elections, I think, proved that the Unionist public accepted our position and validated the decision that we'd taken. I think whenever people talk about the Belfast Agreement or the Good Friday Agreement, it almost needs definition, because when I've listened over the last few days to people speaking on the subject, they have grafted onto it events that took place before the Belfast Agreement, and probably every one of the four or five agreements that were subsequent to that Belfast Agreement. So I think really when people are talking about the Belfast Agreement and speaking approvingly of the Belfast Agreement, they're talking about the concept of partnership, compromise, working together. And that's something that all of us should be able to support.
But what was so wrong at the time that meant you were so venomously against it?
Well, you probably need a longer programme for that one. But at the heart of it was the unaccountability of the executive North-South arrangements. It was the release of prisoners. It was the destruction of the RUC. It was fact that there was no decommissioning and no compulsion to do it under any period of time. And there were a whole range of issues that were part of the Belfast Agreement. But the Belfast Agreement, like agreements before it, had certain common features, and every agreement after it has had common features. I think the principle of having partnership and trying to create a shared society is something that people can support.
But time will now tell, won't it, if we look back, that despite what you said at the time, Ulster wasn't sold out. Northern Ireland didn't fall apart because of it. In fact, you embraced it later on, so you were wrong at the time.
No, I think you've got a strange view of history. What history shows is that the Belfast Agreement collapsed after having been suspended on four occasions and was subsequently replaced by the St Andrews Agreement.
But the Belfast Agreement was not a sellout, was it?
Well, it was. That's why it was rejected by the Unionist community. Originally, whenever the referendum took place, the vote was roughly 70-30, which represented about half of the Unionist community. By 2003, the overwhelming majority of Unionists had found that the Belfast Agreement had not delivered for them, and gave their support to the Democratic Unionist Party and Ulster Unionists, who were against the agreement as well.
And what about those people, Peter, who say that what you actually did was you let Trimble carry the weight, carry the can, and you were strategically sitting in the background waiting to pounce?
No, well, it's not right. I think David Trimble was treated badly, I have to say, during that process.
By your party?
By the people who supported the Belfast Agreement. Blair didn't stand with him when he should have, didn't press when he should have. Sinn Féin didn't deliver when they should have, left him hanging out on a limb.
But what about the DUP?
Well, I think the Democratic Unionist Party got it right. Electorally, I think, shows that we did get it right. The people supported the position that we took. We looked for a fair agreement. I think we actually campaigned under the slogan of a fair deal. And people were quite happy to have compromise, but compromise had to be balanced rather than lopsided, which it was under the Belfast Agreement.
How did Tony Blair let down Trimble?
He didn't give him the necessary support. He didn't press to have decommissioning on time. Let prisoners out without proper conditions surrounding it. There were a lot of things that he could have done to support David Trimble that he didn't do.
What's that say about him?
Well, it says that he didn't support him, perhaps. Didn't think that Trimble was going to be able to carry the day in the long term.
So you think that Blair was strategising, that thought that Trimble can be an acceptable casualty?
No, I think that I always recognised that as soon as Sinn Féin came into the process, that the dynamic of the negotiations was going to change, because the British state was going to want under any circumstances to get a deal that would stop the IRA, stop violence and accommodate Sinn Féin. So they always had the ace card, which was one of the reasons that we left, because our view was that to get into the talks, they needed to sign up to certain principles of democracy.
And so that meant that the thing that you had hammered Trimble for, doing a deal with Sinn Féin, you were then prepared to do. What was the difference?
No, we didn't hammer Trimble because he was prepared to do a deal with Sinn Féin. We hammered Trimble because he was prepared to go into government while the IRA still held on to its weapons, would not give their consent to the police, still wouldn't recognise the courts and the rule of law.
And it was the assessment of the Chief Constable in 2015 that the IRA were still active.
Well,
after you were in bed with Sinn Féin.
No, it was the assessment not just of the Chief Constable but of all of the intelligence services that by and large paramilitarism had ended, but that there were some elements both in Loyalist paramilitaries and in Republican paramilitaries that were still carrying on some activities which were unlawful.
So do you think the Chief Constable was wrong when he said the provisional IRA were active in 2015?
Because
that's important in this context, isn't it?
Well, I think members of the Provisional IRA, I think, is what the Chief Constable said rather than the organisation, which is a distinction that some people may want to dwell on. I think there are members of the Provisional IRA who are still involved in unlawful activity.
Do you think an army council still exists?
There is no evidence, and I rather suspect that the kind of investigative journalists that we have around Northern Ireland would have been able to discover it by now if there had been. The individuals who formed the Army Council, many of them are still about.
When you then, if we get into when you were working with Sinn Féin, how long did it take to trust them?
I don't think that there was any period where we found ourselves up until more recent days that we could not trust Sinn Féin with confidences, and I think that's an important deficit that now exists, that you can't share material with Sinn Féin.
Did you instantly trust them?
We had as part of the St Andrews Agreement a testing period to ensure that they had ended violence and that they were accepting the police and the courts, so that was built in at the very beginning. Of course, any two parties, and it wouldn't matter whether it was Sinn Féin or whether it was the SDLP or the Alliance Party, you obviously have some reticence about the parties that you're sharing power with, and that trust has to build up over a period of time and get stronger over a period of time. And I don't think during my period as First Minister I ever questioned Martin McGuinness's adherence to the principles of the St Andrews Agreement. I think more than that, I have to say...
You never questioned it, why not?
Sorry?
You never questioned it, why not?
I never...
You weren't sceptical of Martin McGuinness?
I wasn't sceptical of his adherence to the St Andrews Agreement. No, I wasn't. I think that he was definitely someone who wanted Stormont to work, who wanted the agreement to work, and who wanted to make progress. And, you know, that was tested on many occasions. When you're marking a major agreement's anniversary... And there's probably about five or six major agreements that took place over that period of time. But every day we were having to negotiate in the First Minister's office. Every issue that came forward was a negotiation. So it wasn't just those big issues that we had to deal with. We were negotiating every day, and we were able to make compromises every day, and we were able to reach agreements every day.
And I'm trying to contrast how it's not working now to why it worked back then. Was that about personal relationships between you and Martin, or what is the difference between then and now?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the problems now, they're not about constitutional structural issues, they're not about security, they're not about those key issues which are key to having ongoing structures. They're about policy issues. Why did it collapse? It collapsed because Sinn Féin withdrew from the Assembly on the basis of allegations that were made against Arlene. But I think everybody knows that when Martin walked away, he was very frail. I think a healthy Martin McGuinness, who had been well, would have taken a very different position.
What about Arlene Foster? Should she not have stepped aside for a matter of weeks or months? Would that not strategically have been the right thing to do?
Well, I suppose none of us know what would have happened if she had stood aside, because...
What would you have advised her?
Well, I think if Sinn Féin were determined to bring down the institutions, and if the real reason wasn't really the RHI inquiry, because they've drifted off to other issues now, they would have found some other excuse probably to bring it down.
So you would have advised what at the time?
Well, I wouldn't have advised. That would be a matter entirely for Arlene. She knew the position, she knew her circumstances, and I don't give leadership from the sidelines.
Would you have stood aside?
Well,
of course you did.
I stood aside in different circumstances, but I think everybody has to make their own decisions on these matters.
What would you have done?
Well, I wasn't in those circumstances, so I couldn't answer
you
that
must have
question.
Thought about
I wouldn't answer that question.
So you wouldn't, not that you can't, because you were a leader for years, you were keeping that relationship together, and it's about a relationship, isn't it? Functioning government is not just about what policies they're agreeing, it's about the two leaders trusting each other.
Well, all I can say to you is that, you know, compromise is part of it, and, you know, you don't succeed if you're simply looking after your own position in these issues. You have to remember that the other party to the executive has a constituency as well, that it isn't sufficient to solve your problems, you have to solve theirs as well. That being the set of circumstances, perhaps a lot more talking should have happened during that period of time. But, you know, I wasn't a party to any of the discussions that took place. I don't know what attempts there were made to try and resolve the issue. All I know is that the end result is that we don't have an assembly that was a lot of people put a lot of graft into getting it up and running. And I think Northern Ireland is the worst for not having a running assembly and executive.
What was the biggest bust-up you had with Martin McGuinness during your time? Like, did it ever get close to falling apart seriously during your time?
No. We had disagreements, of course we had.
What was the biggest bust-up?
I can remember one occasion when we had a press conference outside some event that the both of us had gone, and whatever the issue of the day was, I was speaking and Martin McGuinness was shaking his head, and he was speaking and I was shaking my head. And I think that's the most public any disagreement that we had came to. But over all of that time, I mean, we never had a shouting match at each other. We never fell out to the extent that we couldn't lift up the phone and talk to each other. We continued to discuss things. We still held each other's confidence, because necessarily, if you're reaching agreement on issues, you have to put things out. Is it possible for us to resolve it this way? And, you know, if those kind of issues go out into the public before they're agreed, then you're damaged and the possibility of getting agreement is damaged. And we were able to keep that confidence. And I think that's the big loss that we have in the present time. All of the he said, she said issues that have taken place, I think, have depleted the confidence that the parties can have in each other. So that has to be built up again. And I think going straight back into talks isn't going to do that.
How can it be built up again, though? How can Arlene and Michelle ever trust each other again? Because they're both saying two very starkly contrasting statements about what even happened. One saying there was a deal and the other saying there was not, and there was the leaking of documents. How can those two individuals ever trust each other again?
Well, they're two mature and experienced politicians. They don't have to rely on their own sensitivities at the end of the day. They know they have a responsibility to reach an agreement. And they didn't get very long to work together in government. So the fact is that they have to build up that relationship over a period of time, where, you know, they will both come under attack and have to be defending each other in the long term.
But it's just turning around my mind here that you've just said that in all of those times and political crises that there is during any administration, that you and Martin McGuinness never raised voices with each other, never betrayed each other's confidence. And look what happened when it wasn't you, leader.
Well,
so what's the difference?
I think that the times are different, the issues are different, politics changes over a period of time.
Are the issues different? Why are you suggesting the issues are different? No, they're not.
Well, there was no issue about people determining that they were going to leave the executive because various policy issues hadn't been resolved. The RHI inquiry was coming up, whether it was going to be an investigation or whether it was going to be an inquiry. There were lots of things at that time that had to be resolved by leaders who hadn't had a lot of time working together.
Do you think Stormont should come back anytime soon?
I think it should come back. I think there has to be a lot of work done to bring it back. I think that there needs to be contact, albeit under the radar, to try and build up relationships again. I think that there is no problem that cannot be solved or managed. And I think that just presents a challenge, and people have to work at it until they do get agreement.
And let's think about the outpouring of that. So how would that actually work? So they don't trust each other. When they did trust each other, documents were leaked and somebody is betrayed. So where do they start? What's ground zero now? What do they do?
Well, I think any new agreement has to be a much more broadly based agreement. I mean, when I looked at the agreement, I don't think there was an awful lot in it for the unionist community to say that that was a good deal. It might have satisfied and touched on all of the issues raised by Sinn Féin during the process. But, unionists have issues that they want to be resolved. There are cultural issues that they want to have resolved. So, you have to have a balance in any agreement.
It's interesting that you're saying it was an agreement, that you're saying it was a deal, and your party's publicly saying there was no deal.
Well,
there's a chasm between you and Arling.
No, there's not. I think you need to look at what happens.
When you looked at the agreement, at the deal, Arling Foster's saying the deal didn't exist.
There was nothing that said it was an agreement.
You just said when you looked at the agreement.
Yes, and let me tell you how this operates, because it's been the same since Adam was a boy. The two parties that would be part of an agreement, or the government as well, they talk, they work out what are the issues that have to be resolved, what is it that each of the parties requires to be in any final agreement. When they've worked that out, someone, whether it's one of the parties or whether it's the government, put onto paper what is essentially the working document, but it is called a draft agreement. And it goes backwards and forwards between the parties. Brackets are put round sections that are not agreed. Eventually, you'll work on each of the sections which have brackets to try and get agreed wording. And it is effectively a draft agreement. It is being drafted. It is a working document. But nothing is agreed until everything's agreed. And it hadn't reached the stage where everything was agreed.
Why did you just say when you looked at the deal then?
Because it was a proposed deal. They were working on that deal.
But the DUP, and I know you're not leading.
Well, I think you're getting involved in semantics.
Well,
Well,
here's why it's so important, because that is the.
Well, let's put the word proposed front of it. It is what was being worked on at that time. And in what was being worked on at that time, I don't think that there was sufficient for the unionist community within it.
Why not?
Sinn Féin want to have cultural expression, and they talk about the Irish language. There are people in the unionist tradition who want cultural expression, whether it's through parades or whatever else it might be. But it wasn't addressed in that agreement. There has to be a balance in any agreement. Arlene has to be able to go out to the unionist community and say, I want you to support this agreement, and here's what's in it for us. This is good for us because we've had concerns about this matter and it has been addressed.
But clearly they got to the stage where when they were putting stuff in brackets, that they thought that it was the basis for a deal. And what Arlene did achieve out of that was, well, despite what Sinn Féin said, they wouldn't go back into government without assurances over equal marriage, gay marriage. It wasn't there. There was no standalone Irish Language Act. So did she not negotiate well?
I'm not suggesting that the negotiations weren't going in the directions. They weren't completed. And I would have thought that it was incumbent upon those who were involved in the agreement to wait until the final day when the parties had cleared the document before you would say that there had been an agreement. There was a working document which was a drafting of the agreement that was going to ultimately be signed off if it was supported by both of the parties.
So what should a new deal look like then? You say it should be broader. What should the unionist community be holding out for that wasn't in that document?
Well, you would think that the only people who had problems with the way things are at the present time were Republicans, if you read that document. That's not the case. There are issues that have to be resolved for unionists as well.
What are the key issues?
Well, I've mentioned parades, but there are many other issues, and I'm not going to start telling those who have the responsibility now what they should be putting into the document. But there are issues for unionists as well to get dealing with. And you know, we often said in the process when we were getting stuck on the issues that we were dealing with, if the problem is hard to resolve, make the problem bigger. And you would put more issues into the pot because there was a better ability to be able to set one thing against the other.
If you think about what was agreed, prisoner releases, and compare that which was agreed upon where there was resolution found compared to the impasse over an Irish Language Act, what's in your head?
Well, I don't agree that the prisoner releases should have happened in the way that they did. I think on balance, although there wouldn't be a lot of people in the DUP that would share this view, I think on balance, prison releases had to happen at some time. I think to let prisoners out effectively the day of the after the agreement was wrong. It didn't take into account the sensitivities of those who were either the families of those who had been victims or some who were victims themselves. And I think there needed to be a process that might have been tied in to the kind of truth that people are looking for about what happened to their loved ones. But there were issues that could have been dealt with under that heading which weren't dealt with.
But that's about timing, isn't it? So you agree with...
No, it's not. It's about more than timing. It's about substance. It's about having, again, a balance. If prisoners are going to be released, then what is there for the victims? Are the victims... Are they going to take ownership of their crimes? Are they going to give the evidence that families are looking for of what happened, why people were killed? And you know, there's a whole range of issues that we've been looking at under the legacy issues that could have been part of the requirement before prisoners that were released.
And so, given the fact that victims still to this day don't have that, was that a failure of the administration that you were part of?
No, that was already gone before the administration that I was a part of came in. That was part of the Belfast Agreement.
But you still haven't found the answers for the victims? We still haven't got the answers for the victims?
Well, again, under the Fresh Start Agreement, we had agreed a process. Sinn Féin and the DUP had agreed a process. It wasn't the DUP that stopped that from going ahead, nor was it Sinn Féin, for that matter.
Is Brexit a good thing for the unionist cause?
Well, I think that whether it's a good thing or not for the unionist cause, it certainly unsettles. It is disruptive in our present circumstances. It has to be dealt with. My own view on the issue, I pondered for a very long period of time on how to vote in that referendum. There were a number of issues involved. If I'd been voting solely on economic issues, as they stood at that moment in time, I think I would have voted to remain. But there were a whole series of other issues which caused me to vote to leave. And there was no certainty about the economics because Europe will change. Europe will change economically with the requirement for funds to be going to new members to the European Union. All of those issues will change the economics of Europe. So nobody knew long term what the advantages would be. But irrespective of whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, and I tend to believe that we are better out of the European
Union.
Still
believe that?
Yes. Better to be out of the European Union but have a good relationship with our neighbours in Europe, and especially with the people in the Irish Republic.
How's Brexit going to benefit Northern Ireland?
Well, it opens us up to a range of other markets and opportunities. And indeed, if we are clever about it, it could put us in a very pivotal position in terms of the United Kingdom, depending on what the outcome is of the relationship between Northern Ireland, the Irish Republic, and the United Kingdom and the Irish Republic.
So on the day of the referendum, it was not good economically for Northern Ireland, Brexit. What has changed now to make it good economically?
Well, I said that at that moment in time, as the economy stood, but I don't believe long-term that the economy of Europe would have remained the same. So there were no guarantees that we would be getting the same kind of funding out of Europe as we had heretofore. And I still believe that we can negotiate an arrangement with Europe which will not be to our detriment in terms of trade.
You know, people criticise you for many things, but even your arch critics... will say that you're a deep thinker and you're a strategizer. So when you were voting to leave the European Union, what was your solution and strategy for the border issue? Like how had you thought that through? Because there's an impasse now, a year later.
Well, you say there's an impasse, but there is always an impasse until the moment when an agreement is reached. I have every confidence that an agreement will be reached.
What's the solution?
Well, the solution, I would have thought, is self-evident from the remarks being made by the Prime Minister. She wants the least possible border between the whole of the United Kingdom and Europe as is possible.
So the solution is what? That all of the United Kingdom, those Eurosceptics, are going to jump up and down and say, yeah, Northern Ireland is that important to us that we're going to have
It's in the interest of the whole of the United Kingdom to have as much trade with the rest of the European community, and it is in the interest of Europe to have the freest trade that they can have with the United Kingdom. I mean, there's more coming that way than is going from the United Kingdom into Europe.
And you're confident now that the UK will agree to that?
I'm confident that's what the Prime Minister, I mean, read her speech is fairly clear what the first priority is and what her first objective is.
What about those who say that there will have to be some type of border checks reinstated?
Well, when people talk, sometimes you think there wasn't a border there at the present time. There already is a border. There are issues that have to be, that are dealt with differently on both sides of the border. They've managed to do that without having border checks. I think
but that might change because of Brexit.
No, it doesn't have to change. A lot of what would be required, we don't know what the end result is of the negotiations, so we don't know what the relationship will be in terms of trade between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. But whatever it is, it can be dealt with in this new era with the IT that we have. A lot of it can be dealt with in that way, with perhaps random checks beyond the border. I certainly wouldn't be wanting to have hard border posts along the border, and anybody who knows the border as I do knows how rambling that can be.
There's that deep thinker Peter Robinson on the key issue of the border, IT and random checks.
Well, you think there's a problem with that?
I think there's clearly a problem with that because there's no agreement.
If 95%...
They can't find a solution, Peter. You know
well,
that.
Well, you say they can't find it.
They
as
haven't.
If
it's a fact.
They are
they
working
found
on finding a solution.
A year later, they can't find it.
Well, the one thing that I think that you'll have to accept is that the kind of people that are involved in the negotiations will be capable of getting a deal. Do you really think they aren't going to get an outcome to this issue? I don't. I think it will be resolved.
Do you really?
You talk about. Let's go back and scrutinise what you seem to be aghast at the possibility. We're talking about 95% of the trade that goes from Northern Ireland into the Irish Republic is from small businesses, which wouldn't be affected anyway. So we're dealing with the big companies, if you like, taking stuff north, south and south, north.
Or smugglers, or gangsters.
Well, we have them at the present time, and there's always a differential, whether it's in fuel or aggregates or whatever else it happens to be, and we have to deal with them as we deal with them now. But in terms of the big companies know what they're sending down. You can have a trusted status with the big companies where they share the information electronically, what's going down, so that duty, if duty is there, has to be can be applied. So all of these things can be dealt with if the will is there to deal with them. The freer the trade north-south and UK east-west as well, because don't forget, the Irish Republic require very heavily on their trade with Great Britain.
You mentioned what Theresa May has said. Do you think the DUP are exerting well the leverage that they clearly have because they're propping up Theresa May? Do you think they're getting their due?
Well, I hope that
the due delivery out of that.
I hope Theresa, because I know her from obviously my days at Westminster. I hope it would be her instinct anyway to protect the union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. But the DUP is there to be a gentle reminder at times, and I think they have used their position at Westminster very well.
I wonder how the Tory party, though. I wonder would there be a line beyond which they would say, do you know what? No, we're not going to be bullied by the DUP anymore.
Well, only time will say, and I don't believe that Nigel and his colleagues would characterise their relationship with the Conservative Party as bullying.
Do you think the MPs are running the party at the moment because they've got that power because of the position with the Tory Party?
Well,
do you think
Ireland sure
is undermined by the fact that the power is in Westminster?
I think that inevitably the influence on political matters has shifted to Westminster. I think the sad thing is that it actually dropped somewhere in the middle of the REC because decisions aren't being taken either locally or at Westminster on many of the important issues. And, you know, it's bad enough to lose devolution. But to lose devolution and not have direct rule is the worst of all positions, because essential decisions, literally thousands of decisions, will be sitting on the desks of officials that they can't take or can't have taken because there is no minister there to take them.
I was talking more, though, about the power base within the Democratic Unionist Party. You know, you read article after article that it's now in Westminster, that it's the MPs have control of the party, and Arlene therefore has less control than a leader would normally have.
Well, I don't think that's not the way things work within the Democratic Unionist Party. I think influence is bound to shift on political matters to Westminster because that's where there is active politics. But within the party structures, the leader, the officers, the elected representatives will all act in a coordinated way. It's not the kind of party that goes around fighting with itself. There will always be.
You say that the day that Jim Wells is speaking to the.
Only because you interrupted before I finished my sentence. There will always be a few individuals who will have an axe to grind or will have a gripe, maybe in some cases even justified, and will express it. There will always be those in the party who will leak to the media. That happens in every political party, but by and large, the solid base of the Democratic Unionist Party is a very loyal base.
Just and then I'll move on and then we're finished, but it wouldn't be pro of me if I've mentioned Jim Wells not to put his point to you, which he said in the press yesterday. He said that you promised him that he could return to the job as health minister and that Arlene hasn't followed through on that. Did you make him that promise?
That's not the way I would characterise it, but I'm not going to get involved in those kind of issues. Ultimately, it was up to somebody else to decide who was going to be the ministers.
So you did or didn't make the promise?
I did not make that promise. Those are not the words that I used. I was much more careful about the language that I used. I indicated that he was capable of coming back as a minister, but that's very different. And let me be clear about Jim. I thought Jim was a good minister. Jim did a tremendous job in the Department of Health, which is a very rigorous task to have to perform. He was engrossed in it. I think he genuinely wanted to help in the issues that were involved in the department. And I didn't have problems with Jim in the pursuit of his job. I think he was a good minister, and I think Northern Ireland lost out by Jim having to stand down. But it wasn't just the one issue in terms of Jim. There were several issues all coming, converging at the one time. As you know, electoral politics weren't kind to us at that point.
You've said that the DUP needs to reach out to nationalists. Do you think your party's doing that effectively? Do you think nationalists really think that the DUP is reaching out to them?
Well, I think the DUP needs to be reaching out to everyone. The job of a political party is to persuade and encourage people to give them support.
But you've spoken in the past specifically about reaching out to nationalists. Do you think the party's doing that effectively?
Well, I've talked about reaching out to nationalists in terms of having a partnership in Northern Ireland, but I've also talked about reaching out to the Catholic community in Northern Ireland, because I think the long-term preservation of the union requires us to make Northern Ireland a comfortable place for those who are not from a Protestant unionist background. I think people have to recognise that the demographics of Northern Ireland are such that we need to make Northern Ireland a place where everyone can see the benefits of being part of that larger union with Great Britain.
You see, I thought when I remembered you saying that, I contrasted you saying that to Arlene talking about if you feed a crocodile, they'll come back for more.
Well, you know, Arlene wouldn't be the first person to quickly respond to a question. I think I would have to put my hands up on many occasions, and you might choose your words differently if you had a bit more time to think about it.
I know you're smiling, but is it not actually the language that we use with each other in this country, and this country in particular? Do we not really need to think about it? Is it not really important if there is going to be a time in the future where we trust each other, work with each other, the politicians can work together?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're saying do politicians need to be careful about how they express themselves, of course they do. But people express themselves differently depending on the set of circumstances that they face. And I think Arlene was facing a set of circumstances where, in her view, one concession would lead to another concession. I think that's what she was attempting to demonstrate. I think you're very hard on Arlene. As someone who has been in the First Minister's...
You thought I was very hard on you. It's not my job. It's not my job.
No,
to come around at Christmas.
It's not your job.
Hand you a little card and say,
I think
Happy Christmas.
The public does need to know how difficult that task is. And I know in private conversations that we have had, you have recognised the difficulties that a First Minister... In fact, I think I recall you saying it's something that you wouldn't dream of doing yourself.
I'll say it publicly. I'm not capable of doing a job like that myself. I don't have the depth of knowledge. I do not have the ability. And I think the job that you did, that Arlene did, that Martin McGuinness did, I think it's an incredibly difficult job.
Yeah, well, I think you need to remember the difficulties of that task and give some credit. And I haven't seen an awful lot of credit being given to Arlene for the difficulties that she has had, not only as she has faced them in this job, but in previous jobs, given particularly the background that she had in her childhood and into adulthood.
Do you think that background has affected her decision-making?
I don't. Well, I think everybody's present thinking is based on the experiences of life that they have had. So, of course, that is part of it. Do I think it diminishes her in any way? No, it doesn't. I think it gives her a wider understanding, particularly of those who have been the victims of terrorism, of what they have been through.
Arlene recently said that if there were to be a United Ireland, she would leave the country. Would you?
Well, I wouldn't even contemplate there being a United Ireland. I'm a unionist, determined that
the question now.
Well, it's not. I don't answer questions that are so hypothetical that they're not going to happen. I'm a unionist. I'm going to convince people that the union is the best way forward.
You believe in the principle of consent.
I do. And
if there were to be a United Ireland, would you leave?
I don't believe in the ifs. There won't be a United Ireland. People will want to remain within the United Kingdom because when they ultimately have to take those kind of decisions, they will see the massive benefit of being part of the union.
What would you say to people now? You sit here 20 years later. When you
grey
think
hairs and all.
When you think of the Good Friday Agreement back then and where Northern Ireland is now, like, are we in a precarious place now? Are we in a safe place now? Where are we?
Well, I think Northern Ireland is a significantly better place to live in now than it was back 20, 25, 30 years ago. Unfortunately, a lot of our younger people don't realise what it was like to live in Northern Ireland back three decades ago. So many of our people...
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's good that they don't have to do it, but I think if they had some knowledge of what it was like in those circumstances, I think there would be a greater impetus because the electorate do push politicians. In many occasions, the electorate is ahead of politicians. Politicians always look to their membership. And this is a lesson that I learnt very early as a party leader. They look to their membership, and often the activists in a political party are the purists, the ones who wanted exactly their way as it is in the manifestos, as it has been before. Whereas the electorate have a wider view of issues, are much more flexible. There are issues that I felt that I could never have got through the party structures, which when the public voice was heard on those issues gave the impetus for agreement to be reached. So I think the public has a role to play, and I say that as someone who was a politician and was affected by the public view on issues.
And we're nearly done here. Do you see a generational difference
in terms of what people want for this country in terms of policy?
Well, I'm not sure that there is, of course, a generational difference. There is a much greater moderation and flexibility with many of our young people. But I'm not sure that that's that different than it was in earlier years. I think, obviously, when the bullets were flying and the bombs were going off, that pushed people into more rigid positions. But I think as we came out of that, if you like, war zone, I think people were freed up much more, and young people have expressed themselves much more clearly in terms of wanting to make progress. Now, I recognise that particularly young people will see, you know, green fields, whereas there are a lot of difficulties in getting to it. But it needs that kind of vision and that kind of hope to inspire people to reach the solutions that are necessary.
Yeah, because it's the nature of politics, isn't it, in Northern Ireland? The vast majority of politicians will be older, and yet you talk with this, and I'm talking with this younger generation coming through who might have very different values and ideas and might look to politics in Northern Ireland and think, that's not for me. Those grey-haired men and women are not for me. Is that a problem?
Well, it would be the wrong conclusion for them to reach. If they look at politicians and politics and say that, that is the wrong answer. The right answer is, and I am going to change it. I am going to get into the political parties. I am going to have my voice raised. I am going to attempt to change the outlook of those who are presently ruling over us. That's the way I think that young people should go.
Bill Clinton, who's in town, has talked about, you know, the danger of violence returning, and let's not even let it get anywhere close to there. Do you think it's at all feasible that could ever come back?
Well, there has always been a level of violence. You know, we used to have to be very careful in the words that we used and talked about relative peace. You know, when you compare it to the way it was, you know, when I came into politics, it's a world better now than it was then. But there are still things that are happening. There's still unlawful activity being carried out. There are still people who are being subjected to kneecappings and the like punishments.
Do you think we could go back to the bad old days? Do you think it's possible?
I don't believe that Sinn Féin will go back to those kind of days again.
What do you make of Gerry Adams' comments?
I think he's
violence?
Completely wrong. Completely wrong, and particularly completely wrong.
Just to be clear what I'm talking about, when Gerry Adams said that violence is justifiable in certain circumstances.
Yeah, well, violence is justified if there is a declared war. Violence is justified, in some people's terms, if there is no democratic process that allows you to have a say. That has never been the case in Northern Ireland. There was always a democratic way forward. All you had to do was to convince people to vote for you in sufficient numbers.
Try telling that to some nationalists, Peter. We don't need to go over history.
Their
homes being raided and saw their rights being suppressed. I guess if we talk about modern day, Gerry Adams is saying that, look, you know, if the circumstances dictate it, violence can be justified. Was that dangerous?
It's dangerous and wrong. It's dangerous in that it sends a message to those who are in the dissident Republican organisations that there is such a thing as justified terrorism, and there isn't. So I think he's wrong in doing that. I think what he's attempting to do is to justify his position and the position of the IRA and Sinn Féin in the past. I don't believe their position was justified in moving to violence. I think the SDLP showed, irrespective of the spurious examples that you suggest, the SDLP, I think, showed that it is possible to hold nationalist views in a democratic manner, in a peaceful manner, and to be successful. There were ways for the Republican movement to express itself without violence, and ultimately they have successfully been able to do that through the aegis of Sinn Féin.
I very rarely get to sit and do this with you, so thank you. I'm minded that I've forgotten to ask actually something that's really important, which is, you know, people's lives in this country and all of the issues like health and education that actually affect real people. If we don't have devolution anytime soon, How do you think their lives are going to change? Do you think it's going to get dramatically worse in this country? I'm talking about waiting lists. I'm talking about the education and underprivileged areas. If we don't have that plan that a devolved administration can focus on, because they care more than an English minister, do you think, how do you see Northern Ireland?
Well, it would even be an improvement if there was an English minister taking those decisions, but there's not. There are no decisions being taken in all of those areas.
So what's the civil service in this country?
Well, either you have to have second best, which is direct rule, or else you have devolution. I am a strong devolutionist, have been all of my life. I want devolution to get up and running again. I believe that that's where the energy of politicians
and the expertise... But if it doesn't, what are we facing here? You've seen
a less satisfactory outcome, because ultimately direct rule would have to come in.
But you've seen the charts that I've seen, no doubt, over times of where waiting lists are projected to go. You know, is Northern Ireland going to be a dire place to live in terms of health and education if we don't have devolution?
Well, I think it will be a worse place to live in if we don't have devolution but have direct rule. It will be in an entirely unacceptable place, as it is now, without either.
Do you miss politics?
I have an interest in politics. I enjoyed my time in politics. But everything has its season, and that season has passed for me.
Yeah, well, what's it like not controlling? I'm genuinely interested when you have that power, and then you have to be an observer now. And, like, you've spent a lot of this interview very loyally defending your party, but it must be frustrating, given what's not happening, that you must think that you could do something about it.
I might feel that if I felt that the party was to blame for our present circumstances, and I don't believe that. And I think there's probably enough blame to go round, not just the DUP and Sinn Féin, but many of the other parties as well. Let's be very clear. I enjoyed my time in politics. I haven't found it difficult to extricate myself from that.
I don't believe that.
Well, I haven't. I haven't been sitting shouting at the television or even the radio between 9 o'clock and 10:30 in the morning. I do at times, obviously, feel that something should be said or something should be done about this or that or the other thing. But I have colleagues and I can talk to them.
So, what are you doing with your free time?
I don't have free time. I have at least 3 or 4 jobs.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Triple jobbing, Mr. Robinson? I remember a certain political party giving me a hard time over that.
Quadruple jobbing, but at least it all adds up to what would be about a tenth of your salary.
And this would be... And long may that continue. And this is the final question. When you come out of, okay, a full-time job like that, at your age, do you start appreciating things differently in life? Are you taking up new hobbies? I'm not talking about work now. I'm talking about enjoying life.
Even though I would be fully engaged with various issues, it is a very different kind of existence. You don't have the pressures that you have, the responsibilities that you have. And that's, I go back to the issue where I was asking you to be a bit more temperate in your remarks about Arlene. No one quite understands, and it's not just the DUP leader, but all of the political leaders, they carry a massive responsibility. They have very difficult times. There are occasions when you will sit up at night and wonder, how do we get out of the mess that we're in? So you have all of that lifted off you and placed on somebody else's shoulders. That is a relief. It does allow you to enjoy life a lot more.
Are you travelling much? Have you taken up a hobby?
I haven't travelled that much. But
what's your new hobby you've taken up?
If I want to go away, I will go away. If I want to have a week in the sun and I'm ready for it now, I'll do that. You're much more freer. And every time I went for a holiday, whenever I was First Minister, I was back within 2 or 3 days.
Were
because
you?
Of some crisis. Yes, time after time, I had to come back from holidays because of some crisis in government. And you're leaving your family out there. You're having to come back. You're then having to wonder, should I go out again after the crisis is dealt with? So, you know, that's the life of a First Minister or a party leader.
Final question. What's your message to the political parties in Northern Ireland at the moment, to all of them collectively? What's the message from Peter Robinson?
Don't give up. Continue to work at it. Times may look as if things are very difficult, indeed impossible. But nothing is impossible if the will is there to overcome.
Peter, thank you.
Thanks very much, Stephen.